So welcome to Elaine's. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. This is my wife, Cynthia's, in my restaurant. We are Alexandrian cuisine, so it's Middle Eastern with French and Greek influences, and it's based on my wife's family recipes from Alexandria, Egypt. Thank you all for eating and drinking here. It's keeping us in business, which I really appreciate. We've turned Elaine's into a literary salon, so we have hosted dozens of Mr. Writers of America, Sisters in Crime, writing groups, book clubs. And I've interviewed at this point well over 100 authors, so it's really nice to have you here. We offer free space to authors. If anyone here is an author or knows an author, please tell them about Elaine's and put them in touch with me, and we'd be happy to help them celebrate their work. It's a lonely life writing, and when you can finally get together with friends and family and enjoy your work, it makes a big difference for people. So I'm excited about this interview today. Dr. Mark Bailey writes about the intersection between artificial intelligence, complexity, and national security. He's an associate professor at the National Intelligence University, where he is a department chair for cyber intelligence and data science, as well as a director of the Data Science Intelligence Center. His work has appeared in publications such as the journal Futures, Nautilus, and Homeland Security Today, and he was named one of Homeland's 50 Trailblazers of 2023. Previously, he worked as a data scientist on several AI programs in the U.S. Department of Defense and the intelligence community. He's also an officer in the U.S. Army Reserve. In his spare time, he does ceramics, is a beekeeper, and endeavors to turn his yard into a vegetable garden. So please welcome Dr. Mark Bailey.
Thank you, Jeff. It's really great to be here.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to have you. And first off, this Unknowable Minds that we're celebrating today, that's a really cool and perfect title. Did you come up with that, or was that your publisher?
It was a collaborative effort between my publisher and I would say.
It's wonderful. Congratulations on just finishing the book. I was looking at the numbers recently, and I interviewed so many authors at conferences around the country, and it's somewhere the numbers between 50 and 81%. The last figure I saw was 81% of people say they have a book in them and plan to write one. But of those, only 15% actually write a book.
Yeah.
And of the 15% who start, only 3% of that 15% actually finish the book. And then the number who actually reach publication and get the book out, it's like 1 in 100,000, like of the general population. Like it's a really small number. So it's a big deal. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Why don't we start with just give me a little synopsis, a back jacket copy. Just tell me what is Unknowable Minds about?
Absolutely. So I've been vexed by a lot of the issues related to the explainable nature of AI, particularly in national security or what I would consider to be critical context or critical applications where, AI, I see it as inherently different than a lot of the technologies that we've invented thus far.
Can you hold that a little closer
so they can hear
you?
Yeah, sorry.
Can you hear in the back okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Just a little louder.
Yeah. In the sense that, technology is generally predictable. Like, your coffee maker, you turn it on in the morning and you expect it to do what you expect it to do, unless there's an externality, like a power outage or something like that. If you program it to make coffee at 6 a.m., it's going to make coffee at 6 a.m. But AI is different. It interpolates information in a way and then makes predictions about that in terms of how it's going to behave. That's inherently unpredictable. And so, I teach a class on AI ethics and safety in a national security context. So I've been thinking about this problem a lot. What are the implications of this for technology that we integrate into what I consider to be critical systems? So systems where if it fails, it could fail with significantly bad consequences. So one such example might be something like a lethal autonomous weapon. And so that's what I really started to examine in this book, sort of to dig into the complexity issues with that, because complex systems are inherently unpredictable in a lot of ways. And then also some of the moral considerations with that. So, what does it mean morally if you have a machine that makes a decision as to whether or not the soldier should live or die on a battlefield? Like, that's a very vexing question that I think our policymakers need to start wrestling with. And so that's what prompted the book and what really inspired this whole process.
I mean, it's heady stuff, and it's really significant with high stakes, right, for all of humanity. Who's the target audience specifically for this book?
I really tried to write this for a general audience. I really want the public to start thinking about this problem, but I also really want policymakers and military leaders to think about this. So that's kind of that's my ideal target.
Let me ask you this, because I talk to a lot of writers, and so especially within the fiction writing community, I would say a majority of writers are Luddites, right? And they're very slow to adopt technology, but they're also very slow to understand AI is something different. It's not, somebody said to me the other day, oh, it's like, you know, in technology, it's another weapon and it's whose hand the weapon is in. But that doesn't really work, right? It's framed improperly. So, like, do people understand, in your opinion, and the people that you talk to, especially with policymakers, do they understand this revolution that AI means? Because it's something completely different.
Yes and no. I feel like, you know, my interactions with policymakers when it comes to AI has always been, you know, we need to integrate AI, but we don't really know what that means. So we're like going to throw... we're going to throw AI people at it. We're going to throw scientists. We're going to throw AI contractors. And we're just like, we want you to do AI. But they're like, well, what does that mean to you? We're like, and they're like, well, we don't really know. We just want you to figure it out. We know we need AI because it's the next buzzword. I don't know that. I think they're starting to finally get the idea that AI is inherently different than a lot of other technologies. It's not like a typical technology acquisition, you know, like a tank or something like that, where, like I said, it has a predictable set of behaviors in different environments. I think they're starting to see it as an enabler, but I think people are also starting to see some of the risks because it also does a lot of things that you wouldn't expect it to do. It hallucinates, as they say. It gives you predictions or makes decisions that are sort of outside the scope of like what a human might normally do in these sorts of circumstances. So I see sort of this churning of like, you know, thinking about the ethical use of these things given their inherent unpredictability. But I don't know that we're fully where we need to be yet.
So in the book, you talk about the unpredictable intellect. Is that a bug in the system, or is that actually the function of AI?
I think that's a feature and not a bug. So one of my chapters focuses on sort of the philosophical aspects of complex systems. You know, complexity being a way that we look at different types of systems that don't easily map to easily solvable types of abstracta. So what I mean by that, which sounds kind of heady, but what I mean by that is like, if you have an object moving through space, you can map that using something like Newton's laws or general relativity or some other, you know, mathematical construct that's readily predictable. But if you have, say, an economy and you want to predict the emergence of markets and other types of things in the economy, there's no like equation that you can map that to easily. You have to run some kind of a simulation. You have to run an agent-based model, these kinds of things, or just watch it play out in real time. And so, you know, this is sort of the inherent nature of complexity. And so my question is whether or not that is, you know, just an epistemic challenge, meaning that we just don't currently have the math or the physics or whatever to be able to understand these kinds of systems, or whether or not that's something more fundamental about how the universe itself functions. So something that's more ontological or metaphysical. So I kind of wrestle with that in the second chapter of the book. And, you know, my conclusion is that we just don't know enough at this point. So it could be an epistemic problem. It could be an ontological problem. But regardless of what the actual, you know, fundamental nature of the problem is, it's still something that we need to address and consider as we, you know, continue to integrate these types of technologies into, you know, these types of these critical systems.
And you mentioned modeling is part of the problem that AI is changing the inputs and changing the variables and maybe even changing the desired outcomes as it goes.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's going to add a lot of confounding variables, I think, to how these things function. I mean, right now you have large language models that can code. And what does that mean for, you know, the future of AI where it starts, you know, sort of changing its own code internally? And that's going to add a lot of, you know, additional layers of unpredictability. That's going to make these things even more challenging to really understand and control ultimately.
You talk about chapter 2, beehives and complexity, and you're a beekeeper,
yes,
right? So
yes.
explain to us what you mean by that.
So bees are fascinating. You know, beehives are kind of like a super organism in a way. And just the way in which they interact, I mean, and, you know, like I talk about, you know, sort of the complex nature of bees and use that as an example of a complex system in terms of how, you know, these sorts of these tiny little changes can precipitate what you call like a phase change in the entire system, where the overall dynamics or the topology of the system kind of shifts significantly and the behavior is all of a sudden different. It's kind of like sometimes people talk about chaos theory and the butterfly effect, where you have a butterfly that flaps its wings in Brazil and all of a sudden it, like, you know, through a series of events, it precipitates a thunderstorm in, like, you know, Nigeria or something like that. I don't know. But and that's kind of the same idea, where you have these sorts of you can't necessarily map some input to some kind of an output. And beehives behave similarly, where you can have these sorts of small changes in terms of the relative population of, like, drones versus worker bees. And it impacts the behavior of the entire hive. And, you know, it kind of acts like this super organism in a way. So I think it's a great analogy for complexity.
So you talk about like emergent networks, and it strikes me as there's two different ways to look at that. And one is the AI itself changing and creating complexity that you don't anticipate. But the other piece of it is, like, how much will AI allow us to kind of unravel these emergent networks? Like, how much is a tool to solve the problem beyond causing a problem itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think AI, you know, I don't want to sound like a doomsayer or a Luddite when it comes to this, but, you know, I tend to be very skeptical of AI in certain circumstances. But I think one of the benefits of AI is that because of its inherent unpredictability, it can be helpful for certain types of creative processes. So if you wanted to query AI, you know, for certain ideas, it might come up with ideas that maybe a human wouldn't necessarily think of. So as long as it's a low stakes kind of application, you know, where you're not going to necessarily give the AI control to make those kinds of decisions, in that case, it could be helpful. So in that sense, it might be helpful to try and gain some insight into some of these systems and how they function, but it's still something that we may not inherently understand exactly how it gets to that point, because it doesn't reason. It doesn't, you know, in the same way that humans reason about things, you know, it's interpolating, you know, these high parameter types of, you know, what we call a latent space, which is sort of a mapping of the training data to these parameters. And we can't necessarily gain any insight into how it makes those kinds of decisions. So it's going to be inherently opaque, even if it is helpful for gaining some level of insight into some of these other problems. But on top of that, I guess it creates more problems because of its, you know, its inherent opacity.
You say low-stakes scenarios, and it seems like inherent in everything we're doing, it won't, like, what's the probability that it remains at low-stakes scenarios? It seems like we're integrating it into everything, and by its very nature, it will be involved in everything. So doesn't that almost assume high-stakes scenarios?
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's the whole crux of my book. You know, I don't see a future where we're not integrating AI into these sorts of high-stakes scenarios, which can be terrifying in a lot of ways. I think we have sort of there's a perverse incentive to try and be the best when it comes to developing these sorts of technology. So we end up only asking the positivist question of whether or not we can do something and not the normative question as to whether or not we should. And I think, you know, in the context of global competition, trying to compete with China and other countries and all of this to try and remain at the forefront of developing these sorts of tech, you know, it's going to be it might be hard for us to want to make a moral choice when it comes to this and maybe, you know, slow down some of our tech development, even if it may put us at a strategic disadvantage. So I think ultimately, if we are to overcome that, it's going to require some sort of a global effort and global discussion and global agreement in terms of what appropriate use of AI is in these kinds of national security related systems. So I would envision something like, you know, like a nuclear nonproliferation treaty where everyone kind of comes together and they tend to agree that, you know, this is a bad tech. We don't necessarily want to do it, although that still leads to what they call a mutual assured destruction scenario, which is what we have with nuclear technology, or at least, you know, which was more prominent during the Cold War. But I think that might be the best outcome, even though it's not an ideal outcome. But yeah, it's going to require some sort of global discussion on what appropriate use is, for sure.
I mean, global discussion is great, but every nation has different interests and different goals, and there's, you know, non-state actors, and there's a lot of private industry that's involved. To what extent would even like a global non-proliferation agreement even be feasible? And is it even something we should try for if, like, the genie's out of the bottle?
Yeah.
Someone's going to get there, and shouldn't we get there first?
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly see that as a good argument. I don't know. I mean, I think similar to, like, you know, what we do right now with nuclear technology or biological or chemical types of weapon type systems, which is what I did on the reserve side, is a lot of chem-bio nonproliferation. So I was detailed at the State Department for a while and did some work on nonproliferation for, like, working with the Austaria Group. And, you know, I think it's imperfect, but it helps. You know, it helps prevent the spread of these sorts of enabling technologies for these sorts of things. With AI, it's a little bit different because, you know, I can't walk down the street here and buy yellow cake uranium. But if I have enough money and, you know, enough computational capacity and all this stuff, I could spin up an AI system in theory. So it's more ubiquitous. It's harder to control. But I think we still ought to try to do that. And at the same time, you know, maybe like you said, by being the first to develop these kinds of things, we might be able to, you know, provide some pressure to stop other types of development and, you know, ultimately lead to a mutual assured destruction kind of scenario, which again isn't ideal, but it might be the only best option that we have.
You know, I have a fiction book, The Forever Game, that deals with AI, and I was speaking at an AI conference about 6 months ago, and there were heads of like space programs and things there. And when I was speaking offline to these guys, they were all talking about AI as a life form. I mean, a couple of them actually articulated it that way, but all of them think of it that way. And so if you're looking at really like the top mind that we can have, something that we can't even understand at some point, right? You're looking like an apex life form. It's if we don't get to that one first, or if somebody else does, or even if we do, you know, how feasible is it to even exert some control?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. You know, a lot of times in the AI debate, there's this talk of AGI or artificial general intelligence, which is, you know, what you would think of as like a human-like AI or something that exceeds human capability. I don't talk about that a lot in the book because I think AI presents a lot of challenges in its current state. It doesn't necessarily have to get to that point, but it is always a fun thought experiment to think about that. I go to a conference every year called MindFest, and one of my collaborators there, Dr. Susan Schneider, she's a philosopher of mind and is really interested in this kind of problem. So we talk about this stuff all the time. You know, I think there are a lot of interesting issues with that. So a lot of people talk about the possibility of like AI consciousness, if it isn't, you know, inevitably some other life form, and like, what does that mean in terms of, you know, whether or not AI deserves moral consideration in the same way that we extend moral consideration to other living things that we perceive of as being able to experience something, to experience pain, to experience suffering or what have you, which is an interesting question. Sounds kind of science fiction-y, but I think it's something we ought to talk about in case we do get to that point. And then in terms of, you know, displacement, you know, that's an even scarier scenario. I wrote a paper a while ago. It was very speculative on AI as a great filter and to the Fermi paradox. And the Fermi paradox is this idea where you have, you know, it's sort of an explanation as to why life may seem ubiquitous in the universe given its size and vastness, but why haven't we encountered anything yet? So the idea of the great filter is, you know, maybe there are certain stages in the development of life, either, you know, biological and natural, or something that they do to themselves later on that acts as a great filter that prevents life from becoming, you know, reaching the apex of intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so the thought is that maybe our artifacts, something that we create, ends up wiping us off the face of the planet before you get to that point where you can actually extend out from your home planet and, you know, and encounter some other life form.
So there's an inherent logic in that. It's a little scary.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it occurs to me that we have a mix of people here, and some people I know have a background in AI, but others do not.
Yeah.
We probably should have just defined AI. But could you just tell us basically like what are the types of AI? Because we're using, you know, the AI now, it's in everything and it's growing fast.
Absolutely, yeah. AI is, it's kind of interesting because I feel like the perception of what AI is seems to change all the time. And no one really thinks that what they're using, like the, you know, facial recognition features of their smartphone is AI when in fact it is. The textbook definition by Stuart and Norvig, who basically wrote the most widely used undergraduate textbook on AI, is The Study and Construction of Rational Agents. And I have issue with the term rational because I don't believe that AI reasons in the same sense that a human might reason about something. AI is an interpolation machine, so it interpolates this very high parameter function and makes some inference based on that. And that the way in which it makes that inference is inherently opaque to us because we can't take those billions of parameters and map them to something that we can understand. So you can't really reason through how it thinks, and I use that term very loosely too, thinks. So that's sort of the textbook definition. And then a lot of times people tend to group AI into two main categories. So you have weak AI systems, which are ones that may do one task well. So it might be a facial recognition algorithm on your smartphone, but it's not going to do anything else. Or it might be like a binary image classifier that can distinguish between images of cats and dogs or something like that. And then on the other end of the spectrum is, you know, a hypothetical AGI or strong AI. And this would be a system that basically is cognitively equivalent to humans in every way, or even potentially better than humans in certain ways. So, you know, a general intelligence that can, you know, one potential test, the test for general intelligence used to be the Turing test, but now you have things that can pass the Turing test that I don't think we would consider AGI. And the Turing test is whether or not you have, you know, if you have a human generating something and an artificial intelligence generating something, and you have a human on the other side and they don't know who generated which, can the human on the other side distinguish between the two? So right now, you know, we have large language models that can write things or other types of generative models that can produce images that one can't necessarily discern as being generated from an AI, which is kind of terrifying in and of itself. So where was I going with that? I lost my train of thought there. But, you know, the whole idea, so we're kind of blurring the lines, I would say, between this weak and strong AI.
So the level. So you were talking about, like, you know, maybe AI being self-conscious at some point, right?
Yeah.
And that's theoretical at this point.
Of course.
But, like, how close are we to this more advanced form of strong AI?
That's a really hard question. Even the definition of strong AI tends to change. So, you know, a lot of the people from, like, OpenAI and other AI tech companies tend to, some of them say, oh, we're going to have AGI in 5 years, or we're going to have it in 2 years, or we're going to have it in 20 years. But then the definition of it still changes. So it's like, what does that even mean? What is AGI? Like, is a large language model considered AGI? Because, you know, it can kind of do everything that a human can do, even if it's not, you know, embodied. So it's not interacting directly with the world, you know, but it can still convince a human to do something, which can be kind of terrifying. So my friend Susan, she sent me this series of emails that she got where there was someone who she thought it was a scam at first, but she got an email from this random person who said they were interacting with an AI on GPT, and the AI tried to talk, they were conversing with the AI about, like, robot rights and all this other stuff. And the AI suggested that this person reach out to Susan Schneider and drafted an email for them to send her to try and talk about this and maybe move this forward about, like, AI rights, which is, like, a really weird kind of thing. Like, you wouldn't expect a large language model to be acting agentically in this way. So
it's actually a little terrifying.
It is very terrifying. Yeah. So it's hard to say exactly when you might reach that point because, you know, LLMs already exhibit these things that we tend to impute with these human characteristics. I personally don't think that they have any sort of consciousness. I think, you know, it's a language interpolator. And so without going into, like, the technical details of what that really means, I think it's basically mimicking human language and this sort of agentalness that tends to go with language. But, you know, it's in terms of consciousness too, that's a harder question because we can't even explain consciousness in humans. So how would we explain it or know that it exists in something else, some other non-human type of intelligence? So I think it's an interesting thing to ponder and something that we ought to think about because we don't know exactly if or when we'll get to that point. But I certainly don't think we're there yet.
I mean, it seems like we were just talking about it more theoretically a few years ago, and it's growing exponentially.
Yes.
So, like, what impact will, like, quantum computing have on this?
I think quantum computing is going to be an enabling technology for information processing and a lot of the things that go into AI. I don't know if it in and of itself could lead to AGI, but it could potentially, I think, lead to the development of new types of algorithms that might be better than what we currently have. You know, with a traditional computer architecture like AI is currently built on. So it's hard to say.
You talk about moral hazards.
Yes.
When it brings up a lot of issues, right? But like if something theoretically, like it's analyzing networks, emergent networks that are beyond our comprehension, but it's doing it. So you have something that's acting above our capability.
Yeah.
How are we even able to analyze or interpret what it's doing if it's moved beyond sort of the human's ability?
Yeah, I don't know that that's a possible thing to do. I think it's, you kind of have to trust the output in a lot of ways, which can be, it's kind of scary in and of itself. So I think that's the big epistemic challenge that AI presents in those kinds of circumstances.
And so even that, like, intellectual challenge, right, being able to try to put this in a framework that we can analyze. How do you like put strictures on like using human morality? Like, how do you define it and how do you translate that into something that's not human?
Yeah. I mean, in the book, I talk about different ways, different modes of ethical reasoning, just to kind of give an overview. Cause like I said, part of my target audience are policymakers and military decision makers who are going to have to really think about these problems moving forward. In terms of moral decision making, I sometimes think that's an inherently human thing. I don't know that you can necessarily trust a non-human intelligence to make moral decisions about humanity. And I think one of the you know, one of the horrors of war is the fact that you have to take the life of someone else. And I think that weighs heavily on people who, you know, who act in wars. But would a machine feel that same level of, you know, same moral weight of doing this and of the cost of war, the actual life cost of war? And I think there are also arguments that maybe having a machine make a decision as to whether or not someone ought to live or die doesn't really respect human dignity. So I think these are things that we ought to wrestle with before we would, you know, just sort of integrate AI into those sorts of high stakes military decision making.
I mean, in some ways, morality can work against a mission, right? Like, so yeah. If you give a specific task to AI, but then you have human morality involved or the value of life, mm-hmm. that can often inhibit, right, the actions it takes to achieve the mission.
It could.
So in some ways, those things can be a contradiction.
I guess it depends on whether or not the ends justify the means, or whether or not you take a more deontological approach where you have some duty or some, you know, some duty either to some higher standard or some duty to respect the rights of other people. I wouldn't want to see us lose our humanity in these kinds of things. And I think that removing humans from that equation might potentially lead to that. There's an interesting article that was in War on the Rocks a few years ago, talking about how with AI, we're going to have faster fights and longer wars. And the whole idea is that there's a political and there's a blood cost to war. And that puts pressure on politicians to not just go to war, you know, without really considering these kinds of things. And it puts pressure on politicians to ensure wars are shorter than they could be otherwise. And ultimately, that ends up preserving life. But if you have AI, the battles themselves might be a lot faster, but the wars might become protracted and the conflicts could extend because there's no longer a blood cost to war. Now you could just have war all the time, and that's probably not a world we want to live in.
I mean, don't you see like nation states moving to that though? I mean, you see it already with drones, but why not have robot armies, right? Why not take the human life or the risk to human life out of it? And I understand they could protract the thing or make people quicker to do it, but yeah. It seems like with the goal of preserving life, I can see armies going to that, and at the same time having that turn into a lot more war, which then could have a greater loss of life.
Absolutely, but I think there are secondary and tertiary effects to that. So how do you prevent the AI from, you know, from creating civilian casualties and other types of destruction that extend beyond the conflict itself? So if you have this protracted conflict all over the place, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of other, you know, like secondary and tertiary effects that would be really bad.
So I heard Elon Musk the other day say that he thought there was somewhere between a 10% and 20% chance of human extinction from AI. And I've heard this though from a lot of like futurists and people that are in this space. I mean, what do you put the chances of some kind of a human annihilation based on AI?
Oh, wow. Yeah. So in the effective altruism community, they call this your P-doom. And that's when you interact with a lot of the people who talk about this, they ask, one of the first questions they ask you is, what's your P-doom? So it's kind of a, you know, a dark thing to think about. I don't know. I mean, I try to be optimistic as much as I can. You know, this, like I said, this kind of vexes me, this whole problem, and certainly keeps me up at night. And I wrote the book so I can keep everyone else up at night too. I would say, you know, mine is probably about maybe 15 or 20%. And I don't know that it would necessarily be a super intelligence or an AGI that does it. I think it's more just the inherent complexity of these kinds of systems interacting with each other, you know, leading to disastrous outcomes that we can't predict.
Well, isn't that the real issue, right? Like, once it goes beyond human control and you have these systems working with each other, maybe they're changing the desired outcomes. Maybe they're changing everything in the way they do battle or what it is they're seeking. Isn't that the real danger? Just when humans are completely outside the equation?
Absolutely. There's no control. And, you know, how do you gain control if you lose control of these kinds of systems, especially as they become more advanced?
Well, what are some, like, I've heard some anecdotal things, like in training where the drone couldn't complete a mission, so it went back to kill the drone operator because it was holding him back with mission parameters. Well, what are some of the things, like, in training or real things that you've heard of that are scary?
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is it was an Air Force program, and this didn't happen in real life. It happened, you know, in a simulation. But they trained this this AI fighter pilot to operate in the simulation. And then they played it against a real human pilot in the simulation. And the pilot, the AI pilot did these weird things that like one wouldn't, a human would never think to do in these kinds of environments. And eventually it ended up destroying, you know, a friendly force in order to enable it to achieve whatever its primary goal was, which is really kind of terrifying. If that was to be deployed in real life and actually made those kinds of decisions. Again, it was a simulation. So it's hard to say whether or not it would be able to operate that way in a real life scenario, or whether it would make the same set of choices, but even still, just the possibility can be kind of terrifying. Other examples, I can't really think of anything specific, but there are a lot of, you know, interesting sort of anecdotal examples. Like, you know, OpenAI did this study on this, this game called Coast Runners, where training AI to basically drive this little boat around in this game. And, you know, ostensibly the object of the game is to win the race. But you can also like hit these wickets along the way and earn points. So, you know, they sort of expected the AI to try and win the race because that was the implied goal. But what the AI would do is it found this little cove and just spun with a lot of wickets and just spun around in a circle and hit all the wickets and got as many points as it possibly could in order to win the game. So it did the right thing. You know, it was trained to win the game, but it did it the wrong way, not the way the humans expected it to do. Philosopher Nick Bostrom calls this a perverse instantiation, where it does the right thing but the wrong way. And I think that's where we see a lot of the risk is the AI doing what we intended to do, but not the way we really wanted to do it. And that could be bad.
So in the book, you talk a little bit about the AI weapon systems and how will this affect war in the future? And if like you mentioned the pilot example, you know, the human substrate has its own limitations. So yeah. If you take the human out of the plane, planes can do more, right? Yeah, so at what point, I mean, it's obviously what has to happen, but at what point will the humans no longer be the ones fighting, with no longer in the aircraft? I mean, is this something we're looking at in 5-10 years?
That's hard to say. Right now, you know, the official DoD policy is that for any AI integration, you know, and this could be something mundane, like using AI for like office type work, like, you know, reading emails or like summarizing stuff like that, or even like more militarily relevant applications of AI, you have to have a human in or on the loop. So human in the loop, meaning that the human has to make some positive decision, where it's necessary for the human to make a decision. If a human's on the loop, then the human can make some decision to intervene and stop the AI from doing whatever it's doing. So it's a possibility of intervention, which I think is a good first start. As long as you have, you know, if you have a human in the loop or on the loop at any decision point, you know, you can have a human sort of making that final moral determination as to whether or not the AI should proceed with whatever it's going to do. But I see, you know, I foresee with the, you know, with the ubiquity of AI and the whole point of AI in military operations is to increase the speed of action. And then if we're competing globally with these other countries, you know, there's going to be this perverse incentive to not have a human in the loop or on the loop at every decision point, because that inherently slows down the process. So eventually, I think you're going to see these AI systems nested within other AI systems, which I call the distributed AI problem. And, you know, so I don't think it's sustainable long term to do that. And I could see that happening maybe within 5 to 10 years.
I mean, there's almost no way around that, right? It just makes sense, especially if your competition is doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's unfortunate, but yeah, I think that is the reality.
And so what about with like intelligence analysis, mm-hmm. and using AI when we're talking about it's a better understanding, a way to go into complex networks?
Yeah.
How will AI affect the way that we're analyzing and making predictions and suggestions? How are we going to advise policymakers based on AI?
I think AI can be very useful in certain contexts. So obviously there's so much data, you know, that analysts may have to go through, image data or other types of things. And I think AI can be very useful for parsing through that information. So if you have, say, an AI that can label images of different types of things, so an analyst can then go through and find the things that are most relevant and then make some decision as to what they want to do with that. It's going to be imperfect, I think it's better than having the analyst just do it by themselves. And I think that's a very appropriate use case that we're already seeing with AI in the intelligence field. I think where we might run into problems is if you have AI making targeting decisions down the road, where now you not only have an analyst, you know, telling you what, you know, what the, you know, sort of what the battle space looks like, but you may have, you know, now a targeter using that information to actually select a target for, you know, some kinetic action or what have you. That's where I think we run into those moral problems.
So I just saw an article recently about new aircraft, you know, and look, how has like the planning model changed? Because there's a long runway, right, for some of these weapon systems.
Yeah.
But now that we're looking at AI and AI is exponentially growing, it's being integrated at a faster rate. In that old model of this long range planning for battleships and for human flown aircraft and things, does that make sense anymore?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had a student last year write a really good thesis on that topic and how AI will impact the military acquisition process. And you know, right now the acquisition process is very linear and it has these assumptions about technology, about its reproducibility and reliability. So you know, one of the two things that AI really doesn't have. You can't necessarily expect AI to behave the same way, you know, in different types of environments. Like, you know, the typical acquisition process, you might, you know, you do like your research and development, and then you might do some like, you know, short-term or like short production, you know, testing it in different types of simulated environments and like fielding and then ultimately deployment. And you expect it to perform reliably as you move through this process, but you can't necessarily make that assumption with AI. So it's going to become more of a more complex decision framework where, you know, you're going to have to test what they call AI alignment at different points. Alignment being whether or not AI does what a human expects it to do or aligns with human expectations generally. You know, and I don't know exactly what that's going to look like in the future. My student has, I think, a decent idea, but it's going to take a lot of, I think, policy changes to get to that point. And that's going to require a lot of, I think, you know, partnerships between the government, the people who make these policies, and also I think a lot of our defense contractors who rely pretty heavily on that process to get their products, you know, fielded and all of that.
Beyond like the weapons acquisition, if you're looking at actual like future engagements and you're looking at an adversary that's using AI, and if AI is growing and changing so much and you talk about unpredictability, maybe the way it fights wars is so different that it's not even the weapons that we're acquiring, but it's how we fight wars in the future. Like, how do you plan for basically two AIs fighting each other in the future where we don't even know how they think?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. I wish I had a better answer for it. You know, I mean, Clausewitz said that war is politics by other means, and I wonder if that would still hold true with AI if you have robots fighting each other in the future. Yeah, I don't know.
You're not making me feel any safer.
I didn't like that.
So you also talk about like global competition, right?
Yeah.
And so is to what extent is a private sector ahead or behind government in AI development?
So I guess I think a lot of government AI development is pretty heavily reliant on the private sector. A lot of commercial off-the-shelf types of things are working with contractors to develop different AI solutions. I don't know that the government has a lot of inherent AI development capability. I mean, certainly there are a lot of data scientists and other AI experts working to help, you know, develop these sorts of things. But like these large acquisition projects, I think are mostly outsourced to, you know, to contractors and like, you know, a lot of defense contractors and others who develop these sorts of things. I think, you know, the private sector is generally further ahead technologically than the government. The government is, you know, it's slow by design in a lot of ways, because that slowness sort of prevents, you know, dramatic shifts in policy. So it tends to be more, I would say, in a lot of ways, introspective about making these kinds of decisions, and that you know, inherently slows down the development process.
I mean, so you have this double-edged sword of AI could be used for good or evil. And when you have the private sector that's so involved in the research, doesn't it almost invalidate the approach where you want to have like government restrictions on something? Because I mean, when you think about it, this is the greatest invention of all time, right? Like this,
yeah.
This is a thing that people will be able to control each other. This is a thing that will bring the greatest wealth. This is the thing that will change humanity.
Yeah.
So if we aren't at the forefront of that, and we as like a government, right, at the forefront of that, don't we risk some private entity getting there first and then having this thing where they can do whatever they want with it? It could end up in the hands of an adversary. It could end up, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really valid point. I think, you know, I wouldn't want to just continue to move forward with developing tech just because we can, though. I think we still need to ask that normative question as to whether or not we should. And I think we've seen a lot of examples where, you know, we develop this technology and we assume that it's going to be so helpful, like social media, for instance. You know, social media was supposed to bring people together and, you know, make everyone happy, and it's going to be all cat videos and what have you. And like social media algorithms create echo chambers. And they create sort of different views. They distort reality in a lot of ways, and it creates a lot of political division and other types of things. And it can be dangerous in that way. And, you know, but we never really thought about that when it came to that. We just thought, oh, it's going to be great. So I think we really, especially with something like AI, which I think could be significantly worse in a lot of ways, we really need to think about that normative question as to whether or not we should and what this will mean moving forward. So, you know, I would encourage government officials and policymakers to think about that, but also the private industry. I think, you know, maybe they need to figure out whether or not they should do certain types of things and not just can we make a profit.
I mean, you mentioned social media, and it's ironic, right? That the tools to further communication lead to more stovepiping of information
in a lot of
ways. So those are unintended outcomes.
Right.
So, but they're unintended. So to what extent, like, I guess what I'm saying is if we're holding ourselves back morally, other people won't, right? Like, if you're looking like directed energy weapons or things like that in the past that we've held ourselves back on, other countries haven't. They just kept forging ahead. And when you're talking about something that's so transformative as AI, isn't that in and of itself dangerous enough that we can't allow that to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I see your point. I think that's a really hard problem. And I think it's something that, you know, I think we need to have an informed population to really understand the nature of AI, and then they can, you know, in turn inform policymakers about what their feelings are about this. And I think we need to have sort of a national conversation and even a global conversation about what these norms ought to be. But I think, you know, I understand the whole idea that we want to be competitive with, you know, other countries who may not have the same sorts of moral considerations that we do, or may just have different views completely about, you know, what's right or wrong when it comes to developing this kind of tech. But I really think we have to have a conversation about it. I don't think we should just rely or, you know, trust policymakers to just come to the right decision. I think people need to think about this problem, and they need to, you know, they need to have their voices heard when it comes to this.
To what extent would, like, non-state actors be a problem here?
I think it could very well be a problem. I mean, they're a problem with other types of, other types of disruptive and dangerous technology, you know, acquiring dual-use tech for, like, you know, chemical or biological weapons or things like that. I think it can certainly be an issue. And like I said before, I think AI is going to be a lot harder to control than some of these other dual-use technologies just because it is more ubiquitous.
Is China behind us on this?
It's hard to tell. I think China has their own concerns about AI that differ a little bit from ours, but I think they're still concerned about the same sorts of tech, just maybe for different reasons. For instance, I think, you know, we tend to be concerned about large language models because of, you know, their inherent biases and all of these other types of things, and like how they could undermine democratic norms. I think China's more concerned about large language models because they may not toe the party line. So they may, you know, talk about inconvenient facts like Tiananmen Square and things that you're not supposed to talk about in China. They're still concerned about the tech, but for different reasons. So I think maybe we can find some points of intersection with China where we can collaborate to try and, you know, mitigate some of the worst effects, even if we may have, you know, we may have different end goals for it. But at least maybe, you know, we can find points where we can work together on certain things.
So we've talked a lot about like geopolitical competition, but what about, you mentioned China, right, in Tiananmen Square, and what about that domestic control? What about totalitarian regimes that are able to use this? At the beginning of this, you talked about facial recognition and, you know, just for very early on, but this can obviously get much, much worse in just a few years. What are the dangers domestically with AI?
Oh, absolutely. There's this really, really terrifying video came out from the Future of Life Institute a few years ago. It's called Slaughterbots. And it's exactly what you would think it is. It's these drones that have an explosive payload, and they use facial recognition algorithms to find their targets, and they select their targets based on social media posts that people make. And so it starts out with this, like, kind of, you know, TED talk for this CEO for this defense contractor who had developed these things, and talks about how they're only going to target the bad guys and all this other stuff. And then, you know, as the video progresses, you see, these terrorist groups, you know, basically purchasing these things and programming in certain social media profiles, or just, you know, not even profiles themselves, but just, you know, different qualities that they might want to find people who may have liked certain types of things or have made certain types of posts. And then these drones start going around and basically targeting those people. And the scary thing about that is that all the tech that was involved in that already exists. It could just have to be integrated and done for that particular type of application, because we already have small drones. We already have can load them with, you know, explosive payloads, you know, and we have this sort of facial recognition algorithm, you know, facial recognition capabilities built on AI. So yeah, a lot of very scary prospects, I think, which we'll probably unfortunately see in the near term.
No one here is going to go to sleep tonight. So, in the short term, like, what are some of the things we're looking at? I've heard within 5 years, most people won't be driving. Everything will be automated, you know, and there's little things that affect your daily life, but this seems like it's much, much bigger too. Like, what's your prediction in, say, the next 10 years? What are we looking at?
I think we're definitely going to see more drone applications with AI, AI-enabled drones. Maybe not killer robots like a Terminator style scenario or anything like that. But probably different types of land-based robots that might have some sort of weapon system enabled with them. They might be under human control, maybe to some degree not. It's hard to say. Self-driving cars, for sure, that terrifies me in and of itself. I think we're going to see a lot more AI integration, but we're also going to see a lot more instances of AI doing bad things. So, you know, maybe in a sense that'll be a forcing function where people start to think about this more critically and are like, well, maybe we shouldn't just, you know, throw AI at everything.
Isn't it too late, though? Like, once you see these negative outcomes, hasn't AI already been integrated to such an extent you can't stop?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the cat's out of the bag with a lot of it. I don't know. I don't know what the solution is.
The most disturbing thing about this whole interview, I think, was your bio where it says that you wanted to turn your front yard into a vegetable garden.
Yes.
And I'm just thinking, are you worried about supply chain issues?
Maybe in some ways I am a Luddite. I don't know. I like nature generally. And I like to be around nature, and I like to try and be as self-sufficient as possible. So maybe there's some of that. There's a little bit of paranoia, but I think paranoia kind of comes with my career field, working in defense and intelligence.
A little paranoia is a healthy thing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to come around in just a second for questions. So think of if you have some questions for me. I know a lot of people here know a lot more than me about AI, so I'll be interested to hear what you have to say. I just ask that you speak into the microphone when I do that. Let me just ask you, how long did this book take you to write?
I'd say writing the book took about a year. And then trying to get it through the publishing process took longer.
It's a very long process. So
it is, yeah.
Did you use AI in the writing or editing of the book?
No, not for the writing or editing, but sometimes I would bounce ideas off of it. Like, I'm thinking about writing about this, like, can you give me some, like, I don't know, some ideas? And I think it's useful for those kinds of creative processes.
Was the AI trying to steer you away from the negative chapters?
No, I find, and I think this is kind of interesting. So as I've been experimenting with some of these large language models, I find that they're very agreeable. And I think that they're that way by design because, of course, you know, the tech companies want you to engage with them as much as you can. So if it tells you your idea is dumb, you know, people aren't going to use it. So I think, and that's kind of an inherent bias because, you know, it might tell you something's good and it's really garbage. But I find sometimes it's helpful for brainstorming. So that's kind of what I tend to rely on it for.
Very cool. Okay, I'm going to come around. I had a question over here.
Science fiction, I think, has a tendency to become science fact in a lot of ways. And I think we're kind of already living in a Black Mirror episode. I mean, there are a lot of episodes that deal with AI. And, you know, there's one that comes to mind where they have sort of this social credit system where, you know, people, you know, they like what you do or they don't like what you do. And it kind of changes the way in which you interact with people. And that to me is pretty terrifying. I can see that as a viable future.
So I'm going to go back to AI in the use of a military context.
Yes.
You know, that's my gen. International humanitarian law, the laws of war, are there primarily to protect civilians.
Right.
Right. So what – and they're codified or they are judicially determined or whatever.
Yeah.
So what do you think needs to be in place to continue to protect civilians if AI is going to become more and more – the norm in a military context?
That's a really good question. I talk about that a bit in the book, sort of the laws of war and proportionality and all of that. I could see AI, you know, in the interest of these sorts of rules, making, you know, these perverse instantiations. So maybe AI decides that in order to respect the laws of war in terms of proportionality and minimizing, you know, civilian casualties and all of that, it decides that, oh, I'm just going to wipe all the, all the combatants off the map, basically. So it quickly ends the conflict and minimizes civilian casualties and is, you know, minimally, you know, it's sort of a minimal intervention. So I wouldn't want to see it make those kinds of decisions. But I think, you know, if you're to integrate the laws of war, you have to think about it in terms of a deontological ethic, which is, you know, appeal to duties or rules or the rights of others. And I think ethics is inherently hard to program into any sort of AI system. It's hard enough, I think, for humans to think ethically about a lot of these types of things. So I think in order to get to that point where we could trust AI to make those kinds of decisions, which I don't think it's trustworthy in that way, but if it was to get to that point, it would have to become a lot better at that kind of ethical and moral reasoning.
Mine's kind of actually off of that. How will we know, how will the military know when it can trust certain decisions that AI will make? I mean, at the very sort of personal level, just using large language models, sometimes I'll ask ChatGPT for a list of book titles and those books won't exist. So I know there's still a lot of work for accuracy needs to be done. How will the military and the government know that those things that they want to do with AI and the programs are ready for prime time, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So that's something I try to address in my class. You know, I think ultimately it's going to come down to education. So my friend and collaborator, who the epistemologist Michael Lynch, came up with this idea where, you know, he sees AI as an epistemic tool. And like any epistemic tool, one has to be able to use it reflectively in order for it to be inherently useful. So, you know, in the same sense that, like, you wouldn't really give someone who knows nothing about arithmetic a calculator and expect them to make any sense of it, mm-hmm. you wouldn't want to give someone who doesn't really know anything about AI, how AI works, even if they're not technically adept at AI, like, they don't necessarily have to know everything about how it works, but at least understand its inherent risks and sort of what it's telling you, and also has some sort of domain knowledge that they can understand whether or not it's telling you something that's false or bad. I think that's the point that we have to get to for people to really be able to use it effectively. And so, you know, that's what I, like I said, what I try and do in my class is try and inculturate that idea with members of the intelligence community and military who take my course. And I think we just need to get to that point.
So a lot of people, when they think of AI, they think about these robots, ChatGPT. Is there a type of AI that is something we don't know about? Like, can our adversaries, like almost like cyber warfare, hack our computers, but it be continuously learning and reporting back to other countries?
You mean like an AI-enabled cyber weapon?
Right.
I think that's very possible and quite terrifying. I think that could certainly happen.
Mark, thank you.
Yeah, for sure.
And yes, I won't be sleeping at all for quite a few days, but to your point about having a human in the loop, in the decision loop, right? That requires human effort in perpetuity.
Exactly.
Right? So let's say, you know, and so using, let's say, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, right? Humans, as soon as we get a new fancy capability, right, with our Luddite brains, it leads to disaster early on, right?
Yeah.
Now, what we are putting the assumption on here is that only good faith actors will be in place in perpetuity to keep it at bay, right? When, you know, I mean, in 200 years, if AI deems humanity is the threat to keep it from achieving its potential, right? I mean, we've dug our own graves that way, right? So, I mean, we've let the genie out of the bottle. And, you know, how do we, right, prevent the wolf in sheep's clothing, the pretend good actor, right? And how do we, you know, AI is at one point in time going to say, this is not a perverse instantiation or how you call it, right? That's the right answer. Right and wrong is irrelevant in the computation. So I just want to get your thoughts on kind of that strategic long-term outlook. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that's, there's a lot there. I think So one thing you kind of touched on was what Nick Bostrom calls the containment problem, where if you have, say you have some sort of hypothetical super intelligent AI, and you keep it as like an oracle in a box kind of thing, where, you know, you have some human person who, you know, interacts with it and is the only thing that can sort of, you know, facilitate its interaction with the rest of the world. What's to stop that super intelligent AI from making some determination that it would be more efficient for it to have direct access to the internet or direct access to embodiment or something else in order for it to achieve whatever its primary goal is? So what's to stop it from tricking its human handler into allowing its escape? It could certainly happen, especially if it's a super intelligent kind of system that's significantly more intelligent than a human. It seems, you know, like almost inevitable that it might make that determination, you know, which is kind of a scary thought. So, I don't know if we'll ever get to that point where we have a super intelligent AI. I think there's a chance that we might get to a point where you have something that becomes recursively self-improving in a lot of ways, and which is sort of the scenario that a lot of AI theorists talk about as being the most likely scenario where you would achieve an AGI or an ASI, an artificial superintelligence. And that's basically where you get to the point where if you have an AI that can, you know, rewrite its own code and learn more information and continually improve itself, it will naturally do that in a way that's recursive. So you get like this sort of exponential improvement in its capability. But yeah, it's quite terrifying.
So I'm going to acknowledge that I only understood about 40% of the interview. And also at the same time, I'm an educator of much younger students. And I'm kind of terrified that even in my decade of teaching, there's a lot of skills that have been taken over by AI. The synthesis perhaps being the largest one. In a national security context, do you have any recommendations as to what educators and what our, you know, public school systems should be doing as we prepare students for this, forgive the, you know, triteness, but brave new world?
Yeah. So I think the biggest risk for AI in an educational context is sort of the breakdown of critical thinking. So if you allow AI systems like large language models to basically do that cogitation for you, that could be dangerous because the whole point of education is to learn how to think critically about the world. So I think, you know, but at the same time, you know, it's going to be a tool that students are going to use in different contexts. So I think you have to educate them on the risks of AI, the fact that sometimes it may come up with, you know, books or links or, you know, citations that are completely made up. And so it's not inherently trustworthy in terms of the facts that it provides to you. And also understand, you know, that they shouldn't just use it to write their essay. They have to use it sort of in a conversant way as it, you know, if you want to use it to help you write an essay, maybe you probe it and ask questions and then that helps give you ideas that you can write on your own. So you're still actually applying critical thinking. So I think teaching students that is going to be key moving forward.
Hello, Mark.
Hello.
So I'm going to start by saying my name is Miguel. I do work on a major company who's one of the largest investor in AI in the world. So with that said, my job is also to enhance AI and to make sure that people are using AI. Now, the concept of AI, I think especially we keep it on the dark tones of the worst case scenario, right? It can be transcribed into the whole thing called the Manhattan Project, which was a government-led project. And then even though the government was the one driving it, it wasn't until the first two bombs went out that we decided, holy crap, this is bad. We should probably regulate it. We should probably have some controls around the world about it. And there's also the concept of AI being similar to the Industrial Revolution. In fact, Satya Nadella recently, in the past couple of weeks, kind of made a comparison of AI with Industrial Revolution. And he made a statement that we're not seeing yet the outcomes that the Industrial Revolution brought to the world, but his emphasis was on yet. Now, I feel like a lot of people think of the Industrial Revolution as something that happened almost 200 years ago that have no zero impact on our lives right now. But in fact, is that if you look at what happened with global warming and stuff like that, everything was fine until the Industrial Revolution happened. And that's something that took a couple years, if not decades, to showcase what, like, how powerful it was. And because it was so slow, governments were not involved and companies got to decide what the rules were. And companies got to decide what will happen with people using that technology or how people will develop that technology. And it took us decades for us to start establishing laws and regulations around these things. Now, the train has left the station. We are investing billions, if not trillions of dollars in creating data centers and chips and stuff like that can handle the data processing. We have control of, just to make it even better, we have control of everybody's emails, documents, photos, anything that you do, or your text messages. Everything already exists in some data center stored somewhere, and all these algorithms are already starting to get access to this. There's an argument between companies as to how far they should push ethics. And my company is one of the ones that have actually held back because of ethics reasons. But you have other companies that have said, no, we're not going to do ethics. Let's see how far we can take AI. My question to you is, yes, there was a question there. my question to you is, how do you tell people, someone like me, who is in charge of making sure that we're using AI, that we are developing AI tools for consumers, how do you convince me? It's like, hey, I know that it's a cool idea for you to create an agent that has access to everybody's email, to everything. It can tell someone, like a leader, hey, something's about to happen based on extrapolation from data that so-and-so says something to this person. How do you tell me? I understand the benefit of that, but however, the morals are wrong, we should not be trying to do that.
I mean, that's a great question. I think the legal landscape for AI has yet to be mapped out in terms of, and I think that will impact how companies, you know, make choices about how to integrate AI. I mean, there are existing lawsuits that I'm sure you're aware of in terms of like copyright infringement from, you know, OpenAI basically scanning libraries full of books without the author's permission and then integrating that into their models. We'll have to see how these kinds of things play out, because I think that will potentially shape how companies make these kinds of decisions. And I know, you know, regulation is sometimes, you know, a bad word, but, you know, there might be some room for some appropriate regulation, you know, at a government, you know, from the government to make determinations as to what's appropriate use and what's not. But I don't have a good answer for you now. I mean, I think it's still in that storming phase.
Any questions over here on this side?
Congratulations, Mark.
Thank you.
In a for-profit kind of get there first type of environment, how personally confident are you in the ability for international governments to work together with private companies to create regulations that would mitigate like the possibility of some of these possible terrifying outcomes? And if you are confident in that ability, what does that look like to you?
I think it's certainly possible. I think there has to be will to do it. I don't necessarily see the U.S. having a will to do that right now. Maybe in the future we will. But I mean, it's going to take some, you know, significant international collaboration to get to that. I think the U.S. and its allies are well positioned to kind of lead that discussion. And I'd like to see, you know, hopefully more international discussion as to, you know, to this particular problem.
Those are great questions. What I heard a lot of people saying was coming up with doomsday scenarios, and you saying, I can't really answer that for you.
I wish I knew, yes.
Those are great. Listen, thank you all so much for coming. Now, Mark, you're going to be up here. You have books for sale.
Absolutely.
You're going to be signing books. Yep. Get your signed copy. It's a brilliant book, but it's also accessible, you know, which is really wonderful. So I have two requests for everybody here. One, if you could jump on Amazon and leave them a 5-star review, it makes a really big difference when people don't know an author and they're looking to buy the book. It takes you like 15 seconds. And also, if you like Elaine's, what we're doing with our literary salon and our food, please jump on Open Table or Yelp or wherever it is you rate restaurants and give us a rating. We'd really appreciate it. Mark, thank you so much. It's been really wonderful.
Thank you, Jeff.